Good afternoon, everybody. Before we begin, if you haven't already done so, please silence your cell phones, and if you have soda cans, go ahead and open them. Welcome to our third lecture, honoring the 40th anniversary of Thurgood Marshall's appointment to the Supreme Court. Our series will conclude on May 3rd with a lecture by Randall Kennedy. Special thanks also to Neil Gerber and Eisenberg for their sponsorship today. Professor Day's lectures today on Thurgood Marshall's career as Solicitor General, a position Marshall held directly before he was appointed Associate Justice. Our distinguished guest today was himself Solicitor General for Bill Clinton, and before that was Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights during the Carter administration. Currently, he is the Alfred Rankin Professor of Law at Yale Law School. Please join me in welcoming Professor Drew Days.
Good afternoon. And thank you, Matt, and your colleagues for inviting me and for their very kind introduction. I haven't been here at the university in quite a while, and it's a pleasure to be back in these halls. I've walked them a bit and know many of your faculty members. And to the extent that I don't see them, say hi for me, will you please? Well, I'm very happy to be here to talk about Thurgood Marshall. Matt asked me whether I knew Thurgood Marshall, and only somewhat, in the sense that I knew him as a man, and I spoke to him, and I argued cases before him. But my knowledge of Thurgood Marshall really came indirectly through some people who were very close to him. I had worked at the NACP Legal Defense Fund, so I was the beneficiary of a lot of the wonderful stories about Thurgood Marshall when he was there as director counsel. My favorite is the story about a messenger boy at the Legal Defense Fund who disappeared for a couple of days, and when he came back, Thurgood Marshall said to him, "Well, Johnny, where were you?" And Johnny said, "Well, Mr. Marshall, I had a problem over in family court and I had to go over to Brooklyn." And Marshall said, "Well, did you have a lawyer?" And the messenger said, "Well, yeah, I had somebody helping me out." He said, "Well, why didn't you ask any of us?" He said, "You're just surrounded by lawyers." And the messenger looked at him and said, "Mr. Marshall, I didn't want to go to the Supreme Court. I just wanted to get off." Indeed, a woman who served as my confidential secretary in both of my stints in the Justice Department worked for Thurgood Marshall at the NACP Legal Defense Fund. So although I didn't get to be invited to the family parties and celebrations, she did. And so I had kind of an ongoing report about the justice's activities. And of course, I knew his wife and see her from time to time. And actually, we had a session at Yale Law School a few weeks ago, which, among other people, Cass Sunstein spoke. This was about Justice Marshall and his clerks. And one of the things I did, I was moderating the session, was I brought a bit of memorabilia down from my office. It's a bust of Frederick Douglass. And I put it on the lectern, and when I began my moderating the session, I said, "I think about Thurgood Marshall every day." And there was a strange look in people's eyes. And I said, "Because this bust of Frederick Douglass sat on Justice Marshall's desk during the entire time that he was a justice in the Supreme Court. And it was given to me by Mrs. Marshall on the day that I was confirmed as Solicitor General of the United States." So it brings back a lot of powerful memories about him and his attitudes. I suppose that it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that Thurgood Marshall is really an iconic figure in American law and history. In fact, he's someone who often doesn't have a last name. It's Thurgood. And in fact, last summer at the Westport Playhouse in Connecticut, I saw a one-person show called Thurgood. And I hope they'll be making the rounds of the repertory companies fairly soon. The person portraying Thurgood is none other than James Earl Jones. So I think it'll be a real treat once it hits Broadway and some of the other places like the Goodman Theater here. Now, Thurgood Marshall, of course, is iconic primarily because of his role with respect to Brown versus Board of Education and the numerous other cases in which he was involved, and the pivotal role that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund played in really striking down state-imposed racial segregation in most aspects of our society, beginning with schools and going through public accommodations and housing and employment. It's a transition and a transformation in our society, unlike many other things in the history of this entire country. But of course, he's also known for his service for many years on the United States Supreme Court as an associate justice. But there's a story that's not often told about Marshall's professional life between the end of his tenure as director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in 1961 and his appointment as an associate justice of the Supreme Court in 1967. He spent 4 years as a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, appointed by President Kennedy, and then the 2-year stint as Solicitor General of the United States, appointed by President Lyndon Johnson, from August 1965 to August 1967. It's really about this period that I want to speak today, briefly with respect to his appellate court service and more fully about his tenure as Solicitor General. His 4 years on the Court of Appeals were important in terms of his legal and, I think, emotional development. He was given a recess appointment, and you've probably heard about recess appointments during the last couple of terms of President Bush. This is a way of putting people into positions that ordinarily require confirmation, but when Congress is in recess, these appointments can be made. President Kennedy did so because he correctly felt that there was likely to be very strong opposition to the nomination of Thurgood Marshall by a group of Southern senators, Democrats who, in a word, were racist. And the very thought that any African American could occupy a position of authority in the federal judiciary was something that was anathema to them, and they were pretty dedicated to blocking anything along those lines. At the time that Thurgood Marshall was appointed, there was only one African American Court of Appeals judge in America, William Hastie, who served on the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. So this was not a common occurrence, to put it mildly. Well, President Kennedy was right. What the senators who opposed Marshall did was simply not hold confirmation hearings. And this went on for almost a year. There were requests by the Kennedys, the President and Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, for hearings. One senator would show up and two others would not be there. There was a panel of three senators. Two would show up and one would be missing, and so forth and so on. This went on for about 8 months. And then before 12 months passed, and at the 12-month point, this recess appointment would expire. So it was not simply a calendar matter. It had a constitutional significance as well. Finally, he was voted on and confirmed. But this was a very painful experience for him. He was kind of a fifth wheel in the Court of Appeals. He didn't have a permanent courtroom or office. He was moved around from place to place. And the Chief Judge of the Second Circuit was somewhat concerned because he wasn't clear that if Thurgood Marshall sat on certain cases, that he'd still be around, that in fact, before this case got ultimately resolved, he would have disappeared and the cases would have to be reheard by the Court of Appeals. But he was confirmed and he served with distinction. But by all historical reports of historians, and through some of his friends, close friends that I'm friendly with, he found the life of a judge somewhat solitary and not really entirely to his liking. This was a guy who was Mr. Go-Go. He was going from one scary event to another, from one southern town to another, from one courthouse to another, living with black families because there were no hotels where he could stay, meeting in funeral homes run by black funeral directors because they were the only place where, and I mean this truly, not ironically, where they knew silence would prevail. Obviously, there weren't a lot of people talking in those places, which is the point. Funeral home, get it? Actually, when I was on the staff of the NACP Legal Defense Fund, I had such an experience, and it really focuses the mind to be standing with the draft of a motion for a preliminary injunction placed on a casket. It's just kind of, if one wants to feel one's mortality, that's the place to feel it, believe me. He also wasn't really stimulated by the docket. Once again, this is a man who was arguing cases before the Supreme Court, confronting hostility, winning cases that many people thought would be unwinnable, saving people's lives because he was involved in a number of cases where African Americans were sentenced to death. And through his efforts and the efforts of his staff, were able to save those lives, at least result in their being sentenced to life imprisonment, not executed. So there was not a lot of pressure. There was not a lot of intensity, not a lot of excitement. The rush wasn't there, according to reports. He also wasn't too stimulated by the docket. Second Circuit, New York, commercial capital of the United States, if not the world. That's what they think in New York, at least. I know about the commodity exchanges in Chicago and other important things that you do here. But he got to the point where he joked with his friends that the reason why he got so many of these commercial cases was because he was the only one who had no conflicts of interest. Throughout his life, Thurgood Marshall was essentially a poor man by comparison. By the time he left the court, most of his colleagues on the Supreme Court were millionaires. And since it's required under federal law that justices and other public officials above a certain level have to report their assets, Justice Marshall's assets were always way down at the very bottom of all of those on the Supreme Court who filed their reports. But he worked hard, and among other things, he wrote 98 majority opinions, and not one of those was reversed by the Supreme Court or corrected in any way by a higher court, even if the matter went en banc. But having gone on the Court of Appeals, Thurgood Marshall was arguably in line for another position in the federal government. By that time, Lyndon Johnson had become president. And Lyndon Johnson came to the role of president with many plans. One was, and for those of you who've read about Lyndon Johnson and his tenure as president, in the perhaps most petty way, he wanted to outshine those Kennedys from Massachusetts. He wanted to show that a little boy from the hills of Texas could do great things as president. And he focused on race and discrimination and poverty. This was a guy who was a school teacher in a little dusty town in his early life, who worked with poor Mexican kids, poor families. He had seen a lot. And of course, having grown up in the South, he knew firsthand the crushing burden that racial discrimination placed upon African Americans. And he wanted to do something about it, and he had the skills that he had learned in the Congress to make things happen that I think it's fair to say would not have been easy for the Kennedys to achieve had John Kennedy continued in life and as president. He was the author of the Great Society programs, dealing with questions of exclusion and poverty. But he was also the person who pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. These were remarkable achievements in American history, something that cost him a lot, and some people think cost the Democratic Party a lot in terms of the growth of the Republican Party in the South after Lyndon Johnson left office. And of course, he had the terrible problem of the Vietnam War, which he inherited and ultimately caused him to decide not to run again for re-election in 1968. So when it came to the question of filling the job of Solicitor General, Archibald Cox had been the Solicitor General from the beginning of the Kennedy administration. Archibald Cox, a very distinguished professor from one of those other law schools back east, north of New Haven, I won't mention its name, who had been an advisor to Senator Kennedy, that is, John Kennedy, and who brought a kind of magisterial mean to the role of Solicitor General. Indeed, I saw Archibald Cox argue not as Solicitor General, but as a private citizen when he argued in the Bakke case for the University of California. And he was dressed as a Solicitor General. Up to this point, there's not been a female Solicitor General, but the practice of male Solicitors General has been to wear a cutaway, a swallowtail coat with striped pants, with a light gray vest, a dark gray vest, and a striped tie. Now, there was actually a deputy Solicitor General from Chicago, a woman named Jewel LaFontaine. She was quite a significant figure in Chicago politics, and she served for a while as a deputy Solicitor General. And the rumor had been, when I became Solicitor General, that indeed there was such a thing as a striped skirt worn by Jewel LaFontaine. And so I called her and I said, I have to track down this rumor. After all, I'm Solicitor General now. I can't continue spreading something that is not accurate. Is it true that you wore a striped skirt and cutaway to argue a case in the Supreme Court? And she said, after a pause, yes, I did. And that was about the only interesting thing that happened during my argument. But there's progress. One of the deputy clerks of the Supreme Court suddenly one day showed up in striped pants and a cutaway, and that caught on. And now the marshal, who's a woman, wears striped pants. And before I left the SD's office, I hired a young woman who decided that she was going to wear striped pants. So when she argues before the court, she's up there with her striped pants. So the striped pants can be in all of your futures if you're interested in serving in the Supreme Court. I still have mine, and I'm looking for all kinds of opportunities to wear my striped pants in morning coat and cutaway. I've been trying to amortize it, and so costume parties work, but perhaps I should have worn it today. That would have been a good excuse. But getting back to Lyndon Johnson, consistent with his views of what he wanted to accomplish as president, the notion of appointing an African-American to the position of Solicitor General, the first such appointment in the history of that office. It was created in 1870. This was definitely going to make news. There had been other people considered, but the historians report that there was an immediate chemistry that developed between Lyndon Johnson and Thurgood Marshall. They were both boys from the South, Thurgood Marshall from Maryland. They both were kind of crusty characters, plain talking, liked to tell jokes, had long stories that went on perhaps longer than some people wanted to hear. And they apparently both liked bourbon, which is the great leveler in the South, as anybody who's from the South knows. So this name, Thurgood Marshall, was mentioned to him. Apparently, according to reports, he was on a cruise in the presidential yacht on the Potomac, and in typical fashion, while one of his aides was talking to him, he was stretched out on a bunk, the bottom bunk, and when his aide said, "Well, what about Thurgood Marshall?" he popped up and banged his head on the upper bunk, and history was made at that point. Now, Thurgood Marshall thought this was pretty exciting, the notion of being Solicitor General. After all, he had argued more than 20 cases before the Supreme Court, and he had known the Solicitor General. They had argued sometimes against him, sometimes on his side. But he had a couple of dilemmas. One was, do I give up life tenure as a federal court? That's what he had, to take a job that might not last. When I was Solicitor General, I was reminded daily of the fact that I served at the pleasure of the president. And so people asked me, "Well, what is your tenure?" And I said, "A telephone call." And that's the way it works. So, and the other was, his family didn't really want to move from New York down to Washington. And the story goes that one day, shortly after he was appointed, he was at a reception and at the White House, and Lyndon Johnson came over to him and said, "What's this about your family not moving down to Washington?" And Marshall said, "Well, you know, Sissy's having some problems. The boys are young." Lyndon Johnson looked at him and said, "Do it." And there was no further discussion of that particular situation. So appointing Thurgood Marshall was consistent with this notion of progress, racial equality, openness of opportunities to talent, and so forth. One of the things that's contended about among those who've written on Thurgood Marshall and Lyndon Johnson was whether Lyndon Johnson actually had in mind ultimately nominating Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court if a vacancy became available. Well, he certainly didn't let Thurgood Marshall know that when he said, "I'm going to appoint you to the position of Solicitor General." He said, "And don't think this means anything else." And Lyndon Johnson was very, very private about his plans, and indeed people lost out great opportunities when they blabbed to the press before Lyndon Johnson had decided to make public a proposed nomination. And so he was not going to let on what was going on. But there are other indications that he really did. And once again, this is consistent with the notion that Lyndon Johnson really wanted to be in the history books for a variety of things, opening up opportunities and dealing with the scourge of racial discrimination. It certainly was evident from conversations that Johnson had with many people that he saw Thurgood Marshall's having served on the Court of Appeals, and then if serving with distinction as Solicitor General would make him a very viable candidate for nomination to the Supreme Court. It would basically remove some of the baggage, if you will, speaking in political terms, that he otherwise would have carried as Mr. Civil Rights, the guy who had been litigating civil rights cases for most of his adult life. Who would think that somebody with that background would go the common conversation in Washington, should be on the Supreme Court of the United States, indeed on any federal court, and certainly not as Solicitor General of the United States, speaking for the entire country. Well, Thurgood Marshall worked out the life tenure problem. He worked out the housing situation and set about doing the job of Solicitor General. He was the 33rd Solicitor General, and The confirmation this time around was as smooth as glass. It was kind of a love-in with the two senators from New York introducing him. A couple of questions. It went about 15 minutes. But during those 15 minutes, there was at least one pointed question about whether Marshall, given his extensive experience and indeed fame as a civil rights lawyer, the guy who won Brown versus Board of Education, whether he could be objective in handling civil rights cases that would come across his desk as Solicitor General. And Marshall said, essentially, I know what I did before, and I know what I did after that, and I know what's going to be expected of me as Solicitor General, and I will do my job, and the past is to one side. I will be representing all the people of the United States as Solicitor General, and that was satisfactory to cause the senators to say, let's go to lunch, and end of story. That he would be impartial, I think the word was used by one of the senators in dealing with this whole question of civil rights. Well, not everyone knows what the Office of Solicitor General is about. Indeed, in my tenure as Solicitor General, I knew that the program would have two paragraphs about the Office of the Solicitor General and then maybe something about me, but the most important thing was to explain to the public what that was all about. Indeed, my family didn't show what I thought would have been proper respect for me after I was nominated to the job. When I was nominated, I was told that I should make an appearance in Washington for a ceremony in the Great Hall of the Justice Department, and I'd be introduced to the public, and there'd be an audience of senators and other people of note there. And so my family wasn't able to join me. I have a wife and two daughters, and I think they genuinely had other things to do. In any event, I'll never know. So I went down there, and it was a very nice event, and I was all puffed up with my sense of importance. And so I flew back to Connecticut, and my family was supposed to pick me up. Well, I came out of the plane, walked through the terminal, and walked out looking for my family car. And I saw cars going by, and I didn't see anything that looked like my car. And then I spotted one. I said, I'm sure that's a car. And I began moving toward the curb. And when the car got closer, I could see that there was a red sign in the front passenger window. And myopic as I am, I had to wait until it got even closer. And I suddenly read what it said. It said, no soliciting. I explained to my daughters and my wife that was not what I was going to be doing in the Supreme Court. But basically, it's a position that requires nomination by the President and confirmation by the United States Senate. The Solicitor General is the third-ranking person in the office, official in the Justice Department. I think the number three is not entirely accurate. It's number three because Solicitors General don't want to have anything to do with management. And there's somebody called the Deputy Attorney General who was added to the list of officials later on after the department was established. The Solicitor General oversees all litigation in the Supreme Court. Indeed, has control over what the government does, even in lower courts. For example, if a U.S. attorney brings a prosecution and loses and wants to appeal that decision on legal grounds, and of course he or she feels that there was a miscarriage of justice in this regard, the U.S. attorney sends a request to the Solicitor General seeking leave to appeal. And so it's the Solicitor General who decides whether these cases go up through the federal system. It's a great incentive for government lawyers lower down to win their cases, because if they win and the other side seeks to win the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General has no role to play in that regard. If their efforts to go en banc, that has to be approved by the Solicitor General. Any amicus brief filed in any federal court, in any state court, in any foreign court, has to be approved by the Solicitor General. So it's a very interesting job that, although below the Attorney General in the structure of the Justice Department, has over the years acquired a sense of independence through really convention. The Attorney General has a lot of other things to do with his or her time, and it's just become a commonality in the Justice Department that the SG does the Supreme Court, and every once in a while the Attorney General will say to a Solicitor General, or the President will say to the Solicitor General, I really respect you, I think you're a great lawyer, but you're not going to file that brief, or you're not going to argue that position. But this is a minuscule number of the many, many cases that the Solicitor General sees. I easily approved or reviewed 3,000 applications in 1 year, having to do with appeals or requests to petition the Supreme Court, so it's a busy place. When it gets to the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General's office is usually involved in two-thirds of all the cases heard by the Supreme Court. So the Solicitor General and his staff are always in the Supreme Court. This is either as a party, as the United States of America, or as a friend of the court supporting one of the other parties. The Solicitor General decides what arguments are going to be made and who makes the arguments. He decides whether he's going to argue the cases or somebody in the staff or someone else in the federal government will argue. It is a great job. You're really in the catbird seat. You get an opportunity to see the movement of litigation in federal courts around the country, and it in fact allows the Solicitor General to orchestrate cases, bringing up some cases faster than others, and identifying those cases that will present the position of the United States in the most favorable light. When you hear about the government winning a large percentage of its cases before the Supreme Court, that explains much of that success rate. When you're dealing, starting with a base of maybe 25,000 cases involving the United States government in the lower courts, you can pick and choose and pick the one that really presents the issues very cleanly with a lot of potential impact. So that's what the Solicitor General does, and he does it with a very small staff. It's a little faculty. I don't think that the staff today is more than 30 lawyers. And at the time that Thurgood Marshall was Solicitor General, was even smaller than that. I think he had 5 or 6 assistants. By the way, you'll find this interesting, and you can ruminate on this, but one of the staffers in the Justice Department, in the SG's office during Thurgood Marshall's tenure, was a person you probably never heard of him before. His name is Richard Posner. But he was there, and one can look at the briefs filed for the Solicitor General, and there's Richard Posner's name. Now, what about Marshall as Solicitor General? Well, he had promised that he would be impartial with respect to civil rights cases, but indeed it was the Johnson administration. It was a Johnson Justice Department pushing very hard on civil rights issues. John Doerr was head of the Civil Rights Division. Throughout the South, all suits were being brought with vigor. Prosecutions were being brought left and right. So Marshall didn't have to look around for cases coming up through the pipeline in the field of civil rights. And indeed, as Solicitor General, he was able to advance the cause of civil rights, very consistent with views that he had taken as Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and made a difference in the jurisprudence in this field as a consequence. Let me mention a couple of these cases, or more than a couple, but cases that he actually argued. He argued 19 cases as Solicitor General during his 2 years at the court. But notable among these victories were one, for example, holding in a case involving the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that Congress had broad powers under Section 5 to enact legislation to deal with not only actual discrimination, but with potential discrimination, to enact prophylactic legislation. This involved the question of whether Puerto Ricans who had been educated in English-speaking schools in Puerto Rico could vote. in state elections. On his watch, even though he didn't argue the case, his office had the major responsibility for defending the entire Voting Rights Act from a constitutional challenge. And that was done successfully, and the consequences have been enormous ever since. He was also involved, he argued a case having to do with Virginia's poll tax. You had to pay to vote, and if you didn't pay one year, the dues mounted. And then the consequence was that poor people, even if they wanted to vote, if they had forgotten to pay their poll taxes, simply were locked out. Now, some justices, and I think Marshall saw this as having direct impact upon poor people generally, but in particular, poor African Americans. He was ultimately successful because the court actually embraced more the poverty side of the argument than the race side of the argument, finding that this was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It was kind of unexpected because the court had not really embraced the notion of poverty as a suspect classification. Therefore, this was somewhat a surprise, and you probably learned in your courses that this was one of the high points in poverty law under the Constitution, and it was pretty much downhill thereafter. A civil rights case having to do with California and housing discrimination. California had passed a statute, a law that prohibited discrimination on the basis of racial race, color, national origin, and so forth. And the good people of California got together a referendum, and they amended the state constitution to say, you can't pass laws barring discrimination in housing. And so the question was this state action, was this something that violated the Constitution? Marshall argued that case and convinced the Supreme Court that it was a violation of the 14th Amendment, and that was struck down. This was pretty heavy lifting. There were also, as I said, criminal prosecutions growing out of the work of civil rights workers. One that was quite notorious was when three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. In Philadelphia, Mississippi, their bodies were buried in an earthen dam. You've probably heard about this more recently. And the federal government prosecuted, and the prosecutions were thrown out on the grounds that state action didn't apply, the federal government had no authority to do this. Marshall argued the case, and the Supreme Court decided that, yes, the federal government did have authority to bring those prosecutions. There are a number of other cases, but I think one can draw some thematic jurisprudential threads from this line of cases, discerned in the housing case that I mentioned, in the Mississippi case, and at least two others in which Marshall's office participated as a friend of the court. One had to do with a park called Bakersfield, a park in Macon, Georgia, that had been established by the will of Senator Bacon, a federal U.S. senator, who said he wanted the good people of Macon to have a park as long as the good people of Macon weren't black using that park. And so for years it was segregated, and then there were challenges, and the public officials of the city of Macon decided that they would remove the public officials in charge and give it to private officials. That was challenged, and the Supreme Court struck it down as showing an involvement by the state, therefore violative of the 14th Amendment. And there was one other case, a prosecution of Klansmen, private parties, if you want to call them that, who murdered an African-American soldier in Georgia. Once again, the claim was these were purely private acts, had nothing to do with the state, and the Supreme Court concluded that, yes, there was complicity by public officials, by law enforcement officials of the state, justifying the prosecution. But Marshall did have some tough times. Let me mention just two, with respect to civil rights and with respect to his own ethical and moral principles. It was one thing talking as Mr. Civil Rights, quite another talking as the voice of the people of the United States. Every Solicitor General that I'm aware of has had these difficulties. But in Marshall's case, he was preparing to defend in the Supreme Court a prosecution of a fellow for tax evasion when the FBI informed him that the hotel rooms of the defendant had been bugged by FBI agents while he was discussing matters with his lawyer. Well, this is a no-no, as you probably realize, violating the attorney-client privilege, and indeed threatened to taint the prosecutions and have it thrown out. Marshall was confronted with the question, what do I do? Do I keep my mouth shut? Do I tell the court? He decided to tell the court what had happened, and the Supreme Court threw out the conviction, sent it back, and this fellow was ultimately acquitted the second time around. This fits into something that we call a confession of error. Not precisely, but it is understood among solicitors general and in the office that where there has been a miscarriage of justice, the solicitor general has a responsibility to bring that to the attention of the court and have corrective action taken. In my time at the Justice Department, solicitor general, I had a case where a woman had been convicted of a drug offense and sentenced to prison, and it turned out that she had been sentenced to 5 more years than the law allowed. She filed a petition. It ultimately got through the wonderful mazes that we have to my desk. We concluded that she was right. I brought that to the attention of the court, and her conviction, her sentence was thrown out, and she was resentenced properly. The last has to do with something that I think you'd find somewhat odd. People found it odd at the time. There's a case called Miranda versus Arizona. The Supreme Court accepted 4 cases for review having to do with the use of confessions after police interrogation. One of those cases was a federal case in which FBI officers had been involved. And Marshall assumed the responsibility for defending the FBI's practices along with other law enforcement agents from Arizona, for example, that argued that you didn't have to have any warnings. You didn't have to have lawyers present. Well, the Supreme Court, even though it was impressed with what the FBI had done, because the FBI actually did use warnings, it instituted what we now know as the Miranda warnings. And more recently, under the Rehnquist Court, we found that Miranda was a constitutional decision, not just an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment's impact. Marshall argued the case, and I think he was very conflicted. Someone said later on that this was probably one case where Marshall was not unhappy to see his client lose. But he still had to live with his reputation as Mr. Civil Rights. Chief Justice Warren couldn't resist pointing out to General Marshall, as he was called, and the Solicitors General called, about some other cases that Marshall had argued in the court about poor African-American criminal defendants who were sentenced to death, for example, after having been subjected to very oppressive, cruel interrogation. So he had to live with that, but ultimately the law became what it is today. Well, he left the Jesse's office in 1967, and the rest is history. Marshall described his tenure as Solicitor General as the best job I ever had, and he included everything else he had done. Whether I believe that, I'm not entirely sure, but he certainly felt that, and maybe he said it on a good day. But as you know, he went on to the Supreme Court from 1967 to 1991, 24 years. And one of the questions I leave you with is as follows. Deep down in his heart, Marshall wanted to go on the Supreme Court, as would any lawyer. And he thought, well, maybe if I am a court of appeals judge, and certainly if I become Solicitor General, the chances get better and better. But the odds actually are quite terrible in that respect. As I said, the Solicitor General's office was created in 1870. In that entire length of time, only 4 Solicitor General have gone on to the Supreme Court. William Howard Taft, who went on to become everything, President, Chief Justice, Professor at a law school in New Haven, and so forth. Robert Jackson, who did everything. He wasn't everything, but he did everything. In fact, when he was Attorney General, he thought he was still Solicitor General, to the excruciating pain of the incumbent Solicitor General, and Stanley Reed. So three, and then Thurgood Marshall was the fourth. So in your lifetime, you may see another Solicitor General go on the Supreme Court. So stay tuned, and thank you very much.
We've got a little time for a few questions, if anybody would like to ask some.
Yes. I wonder if you could speak about what kind of input the Solicitor General can have in both the kinds of cases you mentioned. Marshall was conflicted about Miranda, for example, and there were some presumably civil rights cases having to do with free speech during the Vietnam era that might have come up during this time. And during your time, maybe the habeas corpus limitation might come up. So what kind of does the Solicitor General have in saying, well, maybe this isn't such a good idea, or maybe it is a good idea, and so forth?
And idea at what point in the process?
Right. Well,
when it gets to his office?
Well, no, before that, when something's being proposed, for example.
Legislation or prosecution or something like that?
Right. Well, those would be the two different points. One would be when the president is thinking about proposing legislation, and the other would be when a case comes up and you feel like maybe we shouldn't argue this. The Solicitor General.
Right. Well, in terms of the cases that are in the Court of Appeals, which is really the first time the Solicitor General may see the case, if the government loses, for example, Solicitor General can say we're not going to take this appeal. End of story. It's a lousy case. It's not a good theory. The Solicitor General has to meet with public officials in the government, cabinet officers, heads of agencies. And my view was they deserve due process, and so they'd come to meet with me and they'd tell me why it was important for their cases to be taken to the Supreme Court, which they had lost in the lower courts. And I would have studied the matter, and I'd say, well, I feel your pain, and I understand how problematic this is for you, but the answer is no. And it didn't make me very popular, but I think the fact that I really did take time to understand their position and work it through earned me some goodwill in the government. But sometimes I just took my breath away. I thought I was, a bomb was going to descend upon me, or a missile was going to come through my window. Why do I say this? Well, when you talk to the Secretary of Defense, and he calls up and he says, General Days, we've got a case in your office, and we really feel strongly that this matter should be presented to the Supreme Court for review. It has a serious impact on our programmatic works and so forth. And there's a pause, and I say, well, Mr. Secretary, I've studied the matter very carefully. I've met with your assistant secretary and so forth, and I've decided that this case will not be taken to the Supreme Court, at which point I take a deep breath, and that's when I thought, the missiles might come. And the response would be, thank you very much, General Bates, for taking time out to consider this issue and this story. And what it represents is the type of prestige that the office, never mind the incumbent, but the office has within the federal government, not just in the executive branch, but I think throughout. So I got away with a lot just because of the title. And indeed, when I went to the Pentagon, the fact that people called me general caused a lot of people to think that I really was a general. I didn't disabuse them of that misimpression. So is that helpful? So
yes.
The Solicitor General can say, no, we're not going there. I mean, one of the things that I was urged to do by some holdovers from a prior administration was make an argument for capital punishment that depended upon individual courts deciding procedures for how the capital punishment claim should be dealt with. I thought that was completely, to use a term of art, wacko. And I told them and told them to leave me alone. So I was the traffic cop.
All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have. But thanks, everybody, for coming. Thank you.